A reader lives a thousand lives before he dies. The man who never reads lives only one. Come into the reading room, all you lovers of language and literature. This is the place for those of us who believe that reading is essential as we seek to rise above the ordinary. And the reading room contains a host of extraordinary people, leading lights of the written word. Authors, literary critics, columnists, and ideas people will tantalize your minds with their wordplay while discussing the ideas and worldviews that form our wonderful literary milieu. Come step into a world of magic, the place of undiscovered treasures, a room of reading. This is The Reading Room. I'm Melanie Walker, and this is a space where we get to have a look at things that are happening when it comes to the written word, to the spoken word, to music, because of course that's made up of words most of the time, unless you're listening to a Tchaikovsky overture. And of course, the authors who write all of these things, whether it be a songwriter or somebody who's written a book, but primarily I like to talk about books. Now, back in the deep, dark ages that so many people have forgotten, but for many of us it was only like yesteryear, the 80s, one of the best times and one of the most, for many of us, and I'm not saying for everybody, for many of us, the 80s in Johannesburg specifically was an absolutely amazing time. It was a time filled of hope. It was a time that we could do anything, we could be anything, we were going to change the world. And the music was part of what everybody was doing in that particular time. If you throw your mind back to the wealth of bands that were coming out in South Africa, like Johnny Clegg had started doing his thing then, and we went into the more off-mainstream kind of bands like the Asylum Kids and Backstop, and I could go on all day about all the different bands. And it kind of changed every now and then to other bands coming through, like Elemental and Evoid and Petit Cheval and a whole bunch of Helicopters and the people who sang Monster from the Bog. It was a time of complete madness, and something that children and youngsters of today are not going to actually have that experience, because things were changing so rapidly in South Africa for the better for many of us, although people will turn around and say, for you, it was good. But it was a good time to be alive then, in the days when we still were fighting the end conscription campaign and we were fighting to get South Africa into the world again. Now, the musicians at the time, of course, were the people who were spearheading a lot of this. And there's now a not quite tell-all book, but tell-nearly-everything book about what happened in the music scene in the 80s, as written by a drummer. And we all know drummers are very, very weird people. So we can't expect too much of it, but we'll find out from the man himself, Danny DeVet. Thank you for joining us in the reading room today.
Hi, Melanie. It's great, good to be here with you, and to, you know, what a lovely intro. I mean, we partied so hard then because we didn't know what was going to happen around the corner. I mean, we were lepers of the world, but Joburg was and still is a very hard but very unique city, and I wouldn't want to have grown up anywhere else.
So this change, though, from being a drummer into becoming an author, first of all, the name of the book, is it a play on Ian Dury's Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll? Because you've got drums and what? Drugs and rock and roll in Africa.
Yes, it's sex, drums, and rock and roll.
So sex and drums.
We were originally going to call it E-Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll, a play on Evoid, but then there were all sorts of reasons that we didn't do that. One being appropriation. Another one being it was just like we decided to just – so just being the rebel I am, I put the word text down, and then I scratched it out like I did it on the board at school. I used to rub out things and leave rude words on the board. So the rock and roll rebel in me calls it sex, drums, and rock and roll in Africa. And it's essentially how – and I had a real first world rock and roll experience in the third world. And my friend Gus Silber, who I'm sure you may have as a friend,
the most amazing writer in South Africa.
Yeah. We used to all be scared of him because Gus would be all nice to you in the interview, and then he'd go back and he'd sit and he'd write the truth. and he'd see right through any kind of pseudo things. And he said to me, you know, go. I was originally going to call the book Never Grew Up in Vonneberg because I'm still so childish. But, and because the suburb, you know, Vonneberg, I never grew up there, but I was in a band. Yeah, yeah. And, he said to me, write it as though it's someone in Japan who's never, you know, sort of, you must appeal to like a somebody else that would go, hey, wow, there was a whole rock and roll thing going on in Africa. So that's why we went that route for the title.
But that is actually interesting because I think many authors may run the risk of being too South Afrocentric in the way of writing, which might only appeal to people who know or knew the actual milieu and the times that we were sitting in. And it wouldn't make any sense to anybody from overseas unless you were actually part of it. So have you written it, as Gus said you should, from the point of view that somebody can dip into it?
That's why the Vonneberg, 3 chapters of Vonneberg are just wild rock and roll stories that rival Guns N' Roses. So it's sort of showing that there was, you know, that we rocked hard here. I mean, I saw Theo Kraus from the Nude Girls at the Johnny Clegg benefit concert the other day, and it was a privilege for me to read out the bit that I'd written about him. And it's a whole story about how he got into this fight just before he got on stage with a fan, and he was rolling in the grass, and then he got up next to the stage and he had a toke on a joint, and you know, the band had already started, and the manager, Franny Kutzer, came down the stairs and he was like, "Kom nou, al begin," you know, they've just begun. And, he said, "Ek wil net 'n quick kotse." So he had a quick puke. He took a toke of a joint. He washed his mouth out with tequila, and he ran onto the stage and started playing and flawlessly, as out of it as he was. And I ended that piece with a saying, "Keith and Angus, who? He's our own version of that wild, super talented guitar player, rock and roll hero." Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of that element. But then there's also the back sort of story to how Ivoid, the drummer, was arrested, you know, and how I joined the band and I came back and rejoined the band. And not many people know that, you know. And there's only been sort of, I think it's 7 drummers in all the time, 8 now with Peter Cohen, because he played with Ivoid down recently at the in Cape Town. Peter Cohen was with Bright Blue and Mango Groove as well, and Freshly Ground. So he's got a pedigree that rivals mine. But, you know, I've met probably 25 people who said they played for Ivoid as the drummer, because the story's never been told. And I take great delight in busting them. You know, when I was on tour with one of them, they go, "Hey, tonight you're going to meet a guy who was the monitor engineer. He also played for Ivoid." And then I would go, "No, you didn't." So this book
kind of
puts
it all time.
Down officially.
I mean, if you think about that particular time, there were so many amazing clubs and people used to go there. And even though, you know, people are saying, okay, well, some people have a different view of what the 80s were all about because, of course, you know, there was still apartheid and there was this, that, and the other. But for me, hanging out in Hillbrow and just the people, the One-Eyed Mike from National Wake, we were all hung out together. It wasn't a thing of, you know, we weren't, I suppose we'd grown up under the banner of apartheid, but because of our age, we weren't aware of it in such a strange way. And especially when you started partying and you were partying with such a huge array of different people who were all artists. For us, it was never a kind of like a racial thing in any way or form whatsoever, because we were all together in this fighting against
D-Mun.
We were kindred
spirits in that. That I think we empathized with the rest of the world, saying that what the country was doing was wrong. No matter where you sat religiously or whatever, you just knew morally that wasn't correct. And I think that was that was the circles that we moved in. But I remember, Benny, the first time I met you was at a gig that James Phillips played at Gunnar's farm. You remember Gunnar and Pera had a farm? Yeah, so
my best friend Ursula, and they had, when he was still married to Ursula, and they had the band In Simple English. With Rusty Stanley and Andrew Cleland, who also then went on to make Zen Arcade. Yeah.
Yeah. I was dating a girl called Leslie at the time, and she was related to Ursula. In the book, she's called Hot Friend because she has a Lebanese husband now, and I value the rest of my life. So I didn't put her surname in. So she's Hot Friend of my first wife, because when I left my first wife, I said I put all my energy into forming the Electric Petals and one other thing. Oh, yes, dating her best friend. So that was at the time that I met you. So
but
the book's full of those kind of little
anecdotes.
Yeah. And you know, the feedback I've had from particularly expats that are staying overseas, they go, oh, it's so wonderful because we remember that street you described or that club, the Junction or Ponte or, you know, just all those kind of, I try to bring all of that into it as well. The, where the places were and how we walked down the road hitching or the Bromfontein Rec Hall where I played with Steve Howes from the Asylum Kids. He had a band called What Colors, and I was in between bands. I was helping out a band called The Garage Band. And just like, some of the funniest stories are not famous bands, or the, you know, the gems are often just the kind of odd bands that were around,
But do you find that, I mean, because of what we were going through, that kind of informed the music specifically? I mean, I immediately think of the Asylum Kids, you know, like Fight It With Your Mind and all of those kind of songs that came out at the time where we were very anti-establishment. I mean, I'm sure that you also went through that. Did you have to go to the army? Did that, does that come into it at all?
I left that out. No, I left that out completely. I kept it as just a music book. What this isn't in the book, but obviously because of the army. I actually alluded to this. I wanted to put the ECC and the conscription campaign chains across my bass drum when I was in Petit Cheval. And my brother was, instead of doing national service, he was in the police force. And he just said to me, you're crazy. Unless you want to go to jail, they're going to break into your flat, plant drugs, and then arrest you. Nothing to do with that. But go ahead. And I wimped out. I didn't actually put it on. I just thought, you know, I'm just setting myself up to be a target, you know. And then the sort of weird thing for me was I grew up very, all the prog rock bands, and then I moved on and I embraced punk and everything. But I made my mark in Evoid and Petit Cheval, who are pop bands and despised by bands like the Softies. But there were three people that always just embraced me for, saw past the pop star thing with me and kind of got me. And that was Steve Howes, who is a very close friend of mine, and Willem Muller from the Gerard Vermeer Blues Band. And he was in a band called Nothing Personal when I first met him from Cape Town. And Jonathan Handley, who is like a hero of mine. So Jonathan Handley and Robbie Robb to me are the two greatest South African songwriters. And Jonathan was always just so, I remained friends for decades with him. Cause I don't know if you know Jonathan or anything.
I've met him once or twice, yeah.
Yeah, he's such a gentleman and he's just, he's an incredibly talented anaesthetist who has been recording all these songs for all the years. And he's told me some of the rudest jokes, but he always embraced me. So I was kind of half in that scene, but also kind of, as I say, the real lefties saw us as sellouts. Yeah, because we were successful, I suppose, in a
but
way.
There was also the case, with Elemental, this is probably at that stage the top-selling pop band in South Africa, and we're talking about the mid-80s.
Yes.
And, going through to the record stage, the record company, arriving all of them in one tiny little car, and then Brenda and the big dudes would arrive with all of their BMWs. And you suddenly realize that white music, as it was in South Africa, is as much as it was informing the youth of the time, wasn't really a big thing. It just really got the apartheid government's kind of scorn thrown down on it.
So spot on with that, Mel. That's exactly how it was. I mean, there are a couple of Brenda Fassie stories, which are my favorites, actually.
Well, she reckoned I was the only white girl she knew who could dance.
Oh, that's great. And talking about dancing, she humped my leg at the Eric Clapton concert. And then she says to me, in front of her new husband, who was videoing her with this like video camera that we'd never seen, something they'd bought in New York. And she said to me, do you know why Africa's so overpopulated? And I said, why? And she went, cause we've got the rhythm. But that time we all flew to see Eric Clapton. I didn't play that day, but I ended up just hanging out backstage and meeting Eric Clapton. And that's all written about in the book. And chirping him, actually giving him my wise-ass sort of take, because I always reckon the 10 seconds of embarrassment is worth the dinner time story or the picture of a lifetime, So I take my chance with it.
Are those, a lot of the stories, are they like that? I mean, there's lots of pictures of you with very, very famous people here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah, I hope that most of the people who've met me would remember me because I did give them something that they didn't normally get from someone else. When people say, Danny, I've never met anyone like you, I'm never sure if that's a compliment or an insult, but, do you know Mark Vass, the singer of Metal Morphosis?
Metal Morphosis.
So Mark gets, that's how I describe Mark in the book. I said, Mark is the, when you've met him, you've never met anyone else like him. So it could be both ways.
He is a complete Looney Tune. Exactly, I mean, especially exactly. As he works in the corporate world. But I mean, he's almost completely tattooed.
He's
amazing. And that's the one thing. I mean, dentists and lawyers and accountants and those are the people who used to be complete hardcore rock and rollers.
Yes.
You know, and it always makes me think about that whole thing where you see those pictures. This is your grandmother in the 60s or in the 70s. This is what she used to do. She went to Woodstock. She did this. She did that. And the younger generation always see people who are older as being like the older people, like you would have seen who had the blue rinses and, listened to what the government had to say. Whereas we're still the same people.
In our heads, absolutely. And that's, well, I hope that my book reflects that. I'm sure it does actually because
would it actually then be a good thing? I mean, do you think that the younger generation by reading your book would get an idea of the fact that we weren't just these strange people who didn't know anything about anything? Because, any younger generation always thinks that the parents know nothing. Okay.
Well, my aim is totally that they're jealous when they read and they go, why didn't we grow? Like I did when I missed the whole Woodstock thing. I was just a little tiny, tiny kid. And, I always wished, that it would be nice to grow up in the 60s and be a hippie and everything. So I hope that if I could make it as appealing, to them that they would, I started the front of the book with a whole lot of quotes. So the first quote is by Sito from Vonnebaum, and it says, Danny, why do you always have to take things too far? Because I made his life hell for over a decade by pranking and teasing and et cetera. And the second quote is my son, and it says, Dad, please don't be yourself. And that was my son on the way to every school function. Because I mean, I had a mohawk and I met his teacher, Mrs. Faree, in grade 4. He said, Dad, it's teachers meet the parents. Are you going? And I was like, yes, of course, I'll be there on Thursday night. And he said, what are you going to say to her? And I thought a bit and I pulled the car over and I said, what's your name? He said, Mrs. Faree. So I pulled in and I said, I'm going to say, Mrs. Faree, don't take this personally. I'm in the music industry, which means I cap a .45 caliber. Bitch, make my son don't come first in class. I cap your motherfucking ass. I'm Luca's dad. And the strange thing is I actually did it, but I mouthed the word bitch because I wimped out there. But Mrs. Faree took it in good spirits. And so my son has grown up asking me when he was very young, why do Vonnebaum roll their own cigarettes and stuff like that? And he's an accountant and he's rebelled. He's a very good drummer, but he wants to make it in business administration. He's got an honors degree, cum laude. He's busy with a master's already. He's only 22. So I think I did something right in all the madness. And, it's just, we're all normal people, but we were rebels and, it's such a double-sided coin, this rock and roll thing, because I've seen a lot of people go down to it, and I'm sure you have too, Mel. Mm. And I've seen people on the brink who've come back from where you think that's jail or death, and they turn around, and I so salute those people, I've just been lucky. I've never been kind of cursed with any kind of addiction thing or anything, but I have been naughty and I have partied hard.
Well, I think that everybody in the 80s was partying hard if you were of a specific age, in the same way that the people who were that age in the 70s were doing that whole free love kind of thing or disco.
Yes.
And then, of course, Woodstock before that. So each generation has its thing. I just feel, as I said, I don't think that this current generation of youngsters, the kids who are in their late teens going into their 20s, have had anything like that. I mean, even the rave scene before they came along gave you a chance to have this expression, the stuff that you write about. They're not going to have these stories to tell. But I'm quite glad to see that a lot of the rock bands, and as you said at the Johnny Clegg tribute concert, and Evoid played, as did Elemental, although like not the original lineups in some of the cases. But some people are sitting there going, oh my goodness, it's so good to go back to that again, especially as so many of the bands didn't crash and burn, but just couldn't go any further, especially here in South Africa, with the exception of like cool crossover bands, Mango Groove and Johnny Clegg, those kind of people who had that. So I look at these kids and they have no touchstones, no cultural touchstones apart from social media and TikTok.
Mm. Yeah, which is good and bad. I mean, in our generation, the music you liked defined who you were. It was pretty simple. There wasn't gaming. There wasn't all these other ways of expressing yourself or aligning yourself to anything. It was if you had a David Cassidy album or you had a Led Zeppelin album, you were two different people. And that kind of was pretty clear cut what you stood for, you know. And then later in the '80s, if you were into The Cure and the Sisters of Mercy, and you were a certain type of person, and if you were into Rick Astley and Kylie Minogue, you were. But then since the social media, that's all blurred. And and I think the tragedy is that everything is so immediate, so stories don't have a chance to kind of simmer or develop. Yeah, it's just gone. Doof, boom, move on to the next thing. You know,
the attention span has dropped so much.
Oh, terribly, eh? It's only, it's probably, it was 15 seconds, Andy Warhol said. It's probably 1.5 seconds now, you know.
That's absolutely true. I mean, do you think that people these days, especially post-COVID, where everybody thought, oh, I'm going to read every single book I can get my hands on. And then, of course, it was actually too much energy to read, so we'd just watch TV and let it flow over us because you didn't have to engage.
Yes.
Do you think that people might get back into reading, and especially as it's something which was so integral to their lives at a specific point in time? Do you think people are going to get a lot out of your book from that, or do you think
I hope so. You know,
younger
people
will get information from it too.
Well, you know, I think younger people are going to read it by accident, or maybe if their parents are, you know, people are, some of the feedback, and this isn't just hype, I'm telling you the honest truth here, as much as a rock and roll exaggerator would be honest.
Okay.
No, I'm just being an idiot now. No, people are saying they laugh out loud at some of the stories. I mean, you know, and if maybe a parent or the kid saw that and was like, what are you reading? But I think they'd probably read it by accident, but I hope they would carry on reading. It would be engaging enough or interesting enough that they would buy into all the things. Because one, I have I've been blessed in numerous ways. One is I don't know if it's a photographic memory, but I could remember at school, so we're studying valency and it comes up in the exam and I'll be, okay, that's the day that Lucian brought the Uriah Heep record to school and I swapped him with a Status Quo album. Then we walked in from break and then I could see the board and I would write and I would do well. Mm. And I can remember I remember the details, and I remind people of stuff about themselves that they've even told me that I wasn't there. And I go, how do you remember all this? And that's kind of it's a blessing and a curse, because I'm an insomniac since I was a kid. I couldn't sleep. My brain just went all the time. Boom, 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 boom.
So you've got an eidetic memory, essentially. Yeah.
Is that how you describe it? Okay.
Yes,
cool.
Eidetic. So yeah, I also do the same thing.
Is it? So you have the well, there we have that. What star sign are you, Mel?
Oh, no, I don't go into star signs, but we're the best. Okay. I'm absolutely, the star sign I am is the best star sign of all.
And it remains anonymous.
No, it'll be Libran. Libran is the best.
Okay.
The best.
All
absolutely
right.
The best.
So Martin, so you're always on the moral high ground, because Martin from Bonneberg, he would always be the one in the band going, you need to have your equipment together. You need to be that balance. Has to be
we're
right,
control freaks, know. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, a little bit. I love it. Yeah.
So I mean, the book, what made you decide that you were going to write it? Is it because the history of storytelling, and especially not having people to tell it to that would appreciate it as much as we did, and you don't want to lose that? Is it because for that reason that you did it, or is it, I mean, what, why did you decide to write this book?
All right. Thank you. That's a very good question. And I haven't actually answered that yet in an interview. So like that. So if I think back, I left Vonneberg after 13 years, and basically I had my own show going within a show. Once we started doing Unplugged Storytellers, that's my forte. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't really fair on Sito as the front man, because we'd walk on stage and people go, Danny, tell us a joke. Danny, give us a whatever, you know? And we had this crazy thing. And I must just say, they are my brothers. I was on the road with them for over a decade, traveling in the cars. We're still close. We socialize. It was I can't say amicable. It was just a natural thing that happened. But, you know, I was older. Well, God blessed me with a young teenage band in my 40s. I couldn't have had a better midlife crisis. So I'm in my late 40s and I get a band of 26-year-old people, and I love to prank people and I'm childish. And I've got 26-year-old rock and rollers who are stoned all the time and taking every other thing they can to stimulate them and do the most crazy things. And I'm part of that mix, and I'm just pranking people and going mad and getting my rocks off, and they're loving it. Then they grew older. So 10 years later, they weren't the same little fools. And I was growing, if dare I say it, tighter. You know, eventually it was like a thing. So I was like, I can't just keep on being this crazy fool when I'm like I'm already mid-50s. You know, so I kind of cheated life out of maybe 15, 20 years by staying young all the time by being in bands. And my son was also now going to go into high school, and I needed, so that was a natural whole thing. So that kind of, that ended, and it's all detailed in the book. in what I think is the right way.
Okay.
But through all this, when I was in Petit Cheval, I was telling fans stories about Evoid. And then when I was in Electric Pedals, I was telling people stories about Petit Cheval and Evoid. And then when I was in Warner Boom and when I owned the Wings Beat Bar, co-owned the club, and all the young musicians were coming in, I would tell them stories about all those three bands, you know, before. And then in Warner Boom, I would tell, so I kept on just telling the stories. And then I just thought, look, I need to put this all down. And I actually wrote it for my son. If that's a long, long winded answer to you, I thought I'm going to write this and so he can see exactly what his dad got up to and what I was part of. Cause I'm very honored and blessed to be part of that South African music scene. People often say to me, you were in exactly what you alluded to earlier with Elemental arriving in a little car and the whole myth was that we're all driving in limousines because that's what, especially with Petit Cheval, with all the makeup and the styling, you know, and, people say to me, aren't you bitter? If you were in Duran Duran in the same as Petit Cheval and Evoid were here, you'd be living in your own castle, you know?
Yeah.
And materialism aside, I just said, you can't think like that because I could have been the little girl standing in front of the vulture. It was taken by, you know, that famous photo.
Kevin Carter,
So by Kevin Carter, yes. So, I mean, you know, you can't think like that. That's the hand I was dealt with South African music. My riches are all the people like yourself that I've met along the way and that I've interacted with. And that's, I will go to my grave with a smile on my face because of that. And I've detailed that.
So are there any of the people that you like incorporated in the book who've come to you and said, I wish you hadn't said that? Have you had any of that kind of response or is everybody just laughing about it?
Fantastic. No, these are fantastic questions because there is some serious stuff. I always say there's 106 people in the book. This is my little line. 6 villains and 100 heroes, 95 of whom I slept with. But it's not that at all.
You're such a dog.
No, but I'm not. That's the whole thing. So that's just like rhetoric, rock and roll rhetoric. And that's been my, it's kind of my saving grace and my downfall at the same time because I've always got the wise ass chirp. But yeah, one thing I was sitting with a friend of ours, Michael Bender, who was involved with the bands as well. And Lucien and I and Lucien's wife, when he was out for the concert having lunch. I had to say to Michael, I wrote something about the time you arranged that gear and it wasn't there. And I actually felt a bit bad that I put that in because I didn't put all the other good things you did, you know? I mentioned it in passing. And then he was like, Danny, like, come on, man, that was 30 years ago. I said, yeah, but the whole book's 30 years ago, you know?
Exactly.
And then he said, you know, we got into a little debate about it. Then Lucien was very frustrated and moody, Scorpio. And I write all that about how his mood affected all of us and how I wanted to leave the band. Once I heard Schoolboy from the Asylum Kids, I didn't want to do the cover band thing anymore. And Lucien brought it up. He said, well, Danny said I was really moody. And I said, yeah, well, either I was lying or it was the truth. It's a black and white thing.
It's one or the other, yeah.
Yeah. And he said, no, it was hard to read, but, I didn't realize the impact I had on other people, but he said, but I don't have a problem with you putting that in, you know?
But Scorpios are like that. So, I mean, he can be forgiven. He can't help it. Yeah.
So, yeah, there will be people. I'm sure there will be, but I've tried to make it positive. I don't want to come across as a bitter old man and use it as a vindictive thing.
Well, especially as it was a fun time. Sure, there was stuff that went down that was like a lot of the time not that great. But on the whole, I mean, I just keep on remembering the entire thing as being a safe place. It might have seemed quite wild and wonderful to some people, but it was a safe space because we all had each other's backs. Although I have to be honest, I was not around at the time when the Fadgets were doing their things. I was already over in England by that stage and going to see Fad Gadget, which I thought, you stole that name
from. They did. No, absolutely. And also, there was a band called VHF that came to PE when we were playing as a cover band there. We were still slipping our own songs in, but it wasn't Taxi Man and Shadows. It was other kind of stuff. And we were kind of morphing from, believe it or not, from a prog rock band into a new wave band, you know, which is quite a big thing. Because the one thing is that we could all play very well. Same as Petit Cheval. We were very good at our, we weren't little pop stars in like a Milli Vanilli type thing. We were good musicians, you know. So we had to change our mindset. Anyway, this band came and they had a synth bass and they were from Liverpool and they were just like the Depeche Mode and everything. And that was a big changing force for Evoid. So Just some simple things. The Junk Jive riff is the same riff that's used in the NXS song Need You Tonight. So, and that came out after Evoid. But the original, where Lucian got his one was from Talking Heads. Mama, daddy, come and look at me now. And a big, the second verse goes, so I know that Lucian worked that out. And I put that in the book and Lucian was, oh, well, that's true. I did, but I shortened it and I used it. It's going to happen. So there's a lot of, like the Vonneboom CD sleeves, there's all sorts of hidden messages in that the people at the record company are only going to find out in the book. So the album called Tell Someone Who Cares, if you look on the inner spine, there's a number, and if you dial it, it's the Betty Ford Clinic in America. It's just like fun that we had. So I just think, as a music fan, if you grew up with the South African music scene and you have interest in that, you'll find these things fascinating. I hope you will.
Well, I do like the fact that there's a lot of really good music coming back out again, and thanks to places like the Radium and the new Irish pub, Irish club. I mean, there's certain venues, because as we've gotten older, there hasn't been places for us to go. It's for the young people.
So whenever
there's a band playing, and I mean, I know that, for instance, Elemental are going to be playing, with the original lineup. So Herman's going to be flying in from Germany. Adrian, the bass player, has said he will play with them, and they're doing it down in Cape Town. So I'm actually going to go down to that. But do you think that the music scene these days is lacking somewhat compared to the energy which we had when things were such a topsy-turvy time?
Absolutely. A, because of all the cancel culture and everything, people have more fear. I love it. I mean, I've started again gigging with unplugged shows as well to tell stories and promote the book. And so, but I was a drummer. But in the meantime, I've kind of become a frontman by default, by being an idiot when I was a drummer and running to the front and pissing my band off. But eventually now I'm starting again. But I love it that when we get booked again and again at the same place, and then the owner, who's a younger person, goes, Danny, you shake this place up, like all these young guys come in and they all sound like Mumford and Sons, and it's boring. It's the same old, same old. And then also in the older clubs, like the Fireman's Tavern in Edenvale, you've got all these great old musicians, but they're not challenging themselves. They're all playing ZZ Top and whatever the
band. There's nothing wrong with ZZ Top. Don't just ZZ Top at all.
No, but what I'm saying is that there's a whole lot of bands that play the exact same repertoire. So even though some of them were playing in original bands, they've kind of defaulted to that. I still want to play my songs like Hairy Armpits Will Never Change the World, which I wrote for Therese Owen, the journalist, when she's leaning over. I said, those are nice hairy armpits. I'll write a song about it. And she's like, I don't know how I feel about that. Or I have another song called I Love You More Than a Serial Killer, Love Cereal. And so I just love to challenge the people out there, and I think that's what we did in the old days. The bands and the music, like you mentioned National Wake or the Cherry Faced Lurchers, or bands that they didn't just play, the Radio Rats was so subtle in
I was just gonna say the Radio Rats. The words of their songs, and it was so, I mean, that was late 70s. In fact, I love the Radio Rats so much that I took their lyrics and got somebody to engrave the lyrics all the way around the windscreen of my car on the outside.
Oh, wow. Well, from what song?
Good question. I've got to try and remember which song it was. It was a long time ago, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, no. Oh, sorry. I mean, I thought you did. See, I would still do that now. I mean, the Radio Rats were just, I mean, when we did a gig with them when we were Void, and I remember we just worked out Jailbreak by Thin Lizzy, and we loved playing that bam, 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 tonight, you know, a little bit of like little teenage rebels. And when the Radio Rats came on and they played their own songs, and Dave was like, last night I was introduced to you. I mumbled something like, you know, it just made me think we're so irrelevant already then. And so they were a big inspiration to me, the Radio Rats, into not staying a cover band. You know, it was fine to go and play all the Holiday Inns and earn some money and hone our craft. But thank God we didn't stay at that. We didn't stick at that. And we went and actually, because now the one thing, the new generation, the music lives on. They still do know Taxi Man and Shadows and that from their parents and Weeping and stuff like that. So the music is the winner, I think, you know,
But I mean, I, with my kids, I mean, I say, right, I'm going out. I'm going to go and see. We went to go and, who did we see? Tim Parr was playing with Penny Levi.
The Penny Levi. Yes. Yeah. That's Adrian's ex-wife. Yeah.
Yes.
I know Penny well. She's a lovely lady.
So do I. I knew her before I even knew Adrian. So,
really?
We go back a very, very long way.
Yeah.
But, I took my kids to go and see it and they loved it. And to go and see the, now I've just gone completely blank with Marcus Wyatt and his whole group of merry pranksters, Bomb Shelter Beasts. So doing something, and not the jazz stuff, but the mad stuff. And I said to my kids, this is what we grew up with, and my children are starting to appreciate it. So I think by reading your book, they might appreciate what we went through here as young white South Africans in such a topsy-turvy time that we really were fighting against everybody, and there was nothing we could do because we were such a minority. Does that come through in the book at all?
To an extent. But on the other side, a lot of the stories are about kind of the glam side, as small as it was. I mean, with Petit Cheval, I mean, I'll talk about Concert in the Park, and can I tell you one quick anecdote? I'll try of what a great frontman John Selby was. He was the most arrogant person I've ever met, and I'm not in touch with him now. Well, the one story which I nearly sent you, but I was sending you so much stuff. He met Janie Allen, and this was quite a good one. She said she wants to interview him to see who's got the bigger ego. So do you know Nick Hauser from the advertising world at all? I don't know if you know Nick Hauser.
But I know
Nick Hauser
well.
Was a guy who thought up the whole Fadgett image and everything, and then he helped Petit Cheval with all the styling, okay? Nick's very sharp. So Sue Carroll was our manager at the time. She used to write for the Rand Daily Mail. She was the Petit Cheval manager. So she went with Nick and Jonathan, and he said, yes, you'll go as long as Janie Allen pays and it's a decent place and he can bring some of his entourage. So she said, yes, she'll bring – he said he wants to bring his butler and his manager or his manservant, and which was Nick now in a pseudo role. So she brought her friends, and then John just trumped her because he never said a word to her. He whispered into Nick's ear all the time, and he never actually gave her a direct answer. So who had the bigger ego? See, but it was perfect because John wasn't as sharp as Nick. So Nick could say things. But then when she said – what makes Jonathan? Now, this, you must remember, this is in the 80s when Live Aid and the whole We Are the World and everything was out, okay? And Band Aid with Bob Geldof. And as you said, that photo with Kevin Carter and everything, okay? So she asked, what makes Jonathan laugh? And Jonathan probably said something odd. And Nick said, human pain and suffering. And the Sunday Times came out, and it said, Lord Selby, the Lord that isn't, with a snooty photo of him.
I remember these articles so well.
Yeah. And the byline said, he laughs at human pain and suffering. And I was like, oh, well, there's our career. Oh, my God. How can we going to just – no one's going to – the people queued after that. I mean, that whole thing about Mick Jagger, I don't care what they say about me as long as I put my face on the cover, came into play there because that happened, you know. But anyway, so I'll quickly tell you about John. So John, we're playing at the Palm Grove in Margate. We've got like an hour slot as a special act of the night. It's in December. And on Christmas Eve, John used to love to preach to the crowd. Like, South Africa, they say that we're the lepers of the world, and he'd turn it around by punching his chest and going, there's still a future in South Africa. So that night he tried to get into that whole shtick. Sue Carroll used to call him Reverend Selby, preaching at the crowd. And these are holiday makers who've been drinking from lunchtime. They're like, shut up, play the music, let's talk, more song. So John just goes, a young girl died tonight. Her name was Samantha, and she was knocked over by a drunk driver. So think about that when you take your next sip of beer. This doom cloud comes over the whole place. He says, we're going to play a song now we haven't played for a while. It's called Deep in the Heart of a Cool, Cool World. This is for Samantha. So we play the song. We hadn't played it. I've got a lump in my throat. Girls are crying in the front row. And I'm just thinking, this poor family, every Christmas Eve, this is what they've got to deal with, this anniversary, you know. And we come, and then he turns around. He's like, okay, there's a time to mourn. There's a time to be happy. Then he starts getting into the birds, turn, turn, turn sort of thing, but doing a Jim Morrison. And he goes, and there's a time to, are you ready for some magical touch? And he turns the crowd around. Now he's got them in the palm of his hand. Every little thing we do, they are just, because now the gig's got soul. Everyone's felt all guilty about Samantha. And he'd get off stage, and I said, geez, John, that was heavy, man. Did you see it on the news, or did it happen here on the South Coast? And he said, they didn't want to listen to me, so I had to make something up.
Didn't happen at all. If it didn't get written about, it didn't happen.
In rock and roll.
Yep. didn't happen. Yeah. if you weren't there, then you were not part of the whole thing. So now for people who want to take a little ride down the blast from the past, who might have been there, or people who want to find out more about a seminal time, in the changes that were coming up in South Africa, where do they find your book?
Okay. So I've got a website, www.dannydevet.co.za, but it's only being put up in the next week or so. Or they can just DM me on Facebook, and I've been arranging. Books have gone all over the world that way. I did get offered a huge name publisher, but I just, having worked at David Gresham, this is no slight on David Gresham, but, record companies in general, if you sign with a major, you get a small little pittance of kind of the percentage of the profits. So, I didn't want to wait for my royalties for a year. And also, I thought, I did PR for the Parlor Tones. I don't know. Have you heard of them?
Yes.
Then I did my job. So I did for 6 years. So I can promote this myself. I only once the website's up, I'm going to, so you're my first, my first serious interview. I have done a couple just related to gigs, the launches that I had. So I've done it myself, and I'm going to continue doing it that way. So,
fantastic.
I'm on my fourth print. So I've sold, I'm not going to give the figures now, but they're not huge runs, but I mean, there were a few typos in the first ones. Apologies to people. Great little story. I can quickly tell you about that. The first Warner Boom album comes out. We did it indie, and the tracks on the backside don't match the running order to the CD. But now, because in those days you used to print all the art, the artwork at CDT, you'd print thousands because that was the cheapest way to do it. Mm. So we couldn't really change that. So the band were like, what are we going to do? And I said, listen, whenever anyone brings it back, and only a few people did, to the merch table, all you say is, hey guys, just give them one of the normal ones. I've got another collector's item here that's been returned, and not one person. They said, give me my CD back. so that's yours. But I am correcting the typos that were in the book, one or two, but that I picked up, and then.
Well, send it to me and I'll sub it for you. I'm very good at doing that.
Oh, great. Thank you.
but I wanted to say that if you aren't in the book, then you weren't really there. But I know I'm not in the book, so therefore, I'm not going to say that.
I think you might be. No, I actually think you might be. I don't want to, it's such a big book. And I definitely wrote about you, and they took out, it was going to be over 1,000 pages, and they had to take a whole lot out. So there's a chance you're still in there if that story made the cuts,
Yeah. But I used to fly underneath everything, going and putting posters up for various bands in the middle of the night in Hillbrow, being a roadie, all of that kind of stuff. So I was
are mentioned in the book. There are a lot of people because I wrote it as who was there, what happened, boom, 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 So, there's a lot of bands mentioned. And also with all the bands that played at Wings, Wings was another, in the 90s, there was another whole resurgence of bands like Urban Creep and Squeal and the Springbok New Girls. They all came then. And
that was just after that way.
Yes. But they would all come through. They all played at Wings. So Boo, bands like that, and Matthew van der Vant and all those artists that came through at the time. Henry VIII, I don't know if you remember Karma.
With Karma, I'm still friends with her. And there was also 206 used to do a lot of that, where 206 was still in Louis Botha Avenue. So there was a lot of that stuff that happened.
But exactly.
It wasn't the same as the 80s.
No, it wasn't,
frankly.
But you're right. It wasn't as intense, but there were a lot of good bands that came through then. So there are stories all about that. And all the bands that played at Wings, I actually listed, I put a list at the end of the book so that their names of those bands can kind of be immortalized on the book, in the book. So I think that's quite nice. So if you had your band and you were in the 90s and you played at my club, I put your name at the end of the book.
I have to be honest, I'm more of a Prime Circle girl than a Parlor Tones girl.
It's crazy. I signed Prime Circle to Gresham, so there's the Prime Circle stories in there as well.
Great band.
The two biggest bands that I was involved in without playing in was the Parlor Tones and then Nickelback, and I wouldn't buy either album, I love the Parlor Tones as people, but I would never really go and buy a Parlor Tones album, And I played on stage with them and everything, and they know that because I've told them, And Nickelback as well, I wouldn't, but I was the Roadrunner label manager, and I ended up doing that huge hits and everything, which was very great for the record company and for my job, but It's just, I think it's God's humor, because God works in really funny ways. The two bands that are, you know.
I love Nickelback. I'm one of those people.
Oh, that's great. Well, then, yeah, but for me, I wouldn't, you know. It was just like a weird thing. But yeah, anyway. But it's fun to tell people that, that I was the guy that brought Nickelback to South Africa. It's via David Gresham, of course, working for him, you know.
So one question for you. Of the bands, which was the absolute best, do you reckon, in the 80s? Which was the one that gave the best stories, and which one had the best music that's lasted till today?
Okay, before I answer that, I have to say the wildest stories are in the Bonaboom chapter. That was the most real rock and roll band I ever played in. It was like the real deal. It was, you know, we felt like that. I tell it to my son. We felt like we were the guys who'd robbed the bank, and we were riding off with all the women on the back of our horses. that brotherhood rebel thing. Okay. Mm. Are you saying the bands I played in, or the bands?
The bands of the time.
Well, I reckon Robbie Robb has the best stories. I've told one or two of his. Because he was in two huge bands that were, you know.
Asylum Kids and Tribe After Tribe. And don't forget, that's of course, correct. They also did Shag before that with Cliffy Ely and Robbie Whitehall.
Well, there's
Whitehall.
A story. That's how I met him. Mel, that's how I met
Chelsea
him.
Chelsea Underground.
No, we played a festival, and Void played, and Robbie was there, and we blew the crowd away, because we played a 17-minute prog rock original, and Robbie walks up to me and he went, "We're a boogie band."
Because
I love that about him, and I knew he's going to be just someone I'm going to run into all the time. And, because Robbie was very competitive, although he always made out he wasn't. He was like, no, it's not the music and the jamming, but he wasn't. And I loved him for that, you know? So I would say he had the best stories, but I think for the shock factor, the Petit Cheval stories, because we were kind of riding a wave. It burnt brightly, but it burnt very short. But the Evoid music has lasted so long. So the backstory of Evoid and the anecdotes there are something I think people will buy into, because they still know those songs and they still love those songs.
Well, I do hope that everybody who actually wants to get into a bit of a blast from the past, get out of the shackles of like post-yuppiedom and go back to their actual roots. I think that they should be getting hold of your book. And I wish you the best of luck with it. And thank you very much for having taking the time out to come and chat. It's lovely to go for a little walk down Melanie Lane.
Oh, I love it. Oh, can I steal that? I'm going to tell people. I'm going to use that. And I just have to just put one sort of final official disclaimer here. I was never a drummer. I was always a drama.
Oh, we know that you drummers are a bit weird. Daddy DeVette, thank you so very much.
Thank
and we'll
you
catch
so
up with
much,
you again
Melanie.
Soon.
Okay. Thank you. God bless you, and thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.